Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Thank you, Ed. On Wednesday, August 12th, welcome everybody to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Cherry Gregg.
You've likely seen the headlines about this wave of cyber attacks that targeted water systems all over the country, including a couple right here in South Jersey. And the good news is that as far as we know, no one's been hurt. There haven't been any adverse health effects. The bad news is that this exposes a real vulnerability in our infrastructure. Because if adversaries, and it seems like Iran is behind this wave of attacks, if adversaries can target water systems, there's a lot of damage they could potentially do. Same goes for electricity grids, oil and gas pipelines. The list goes on and on. So we have a couple of cyber experts with us today to walk us through what we know about these attacks and what they reveal about the vulnerabilities of our infrastructure here in America. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you been hearing about this? Do you have questions about this? Do you feel a little unnerved? And what do you think the U.S. should do to prevent hacks on utility systems? Are you doing anything to prepare? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. The phone lines are wide open. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're on YouTube or Facebook, hello, you can drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, looking forward to this conversation, Avi. I think this is one of those things that people have been thinking about for a long time, and I'm almost surprised there hasn't been more damage or more attempts yet, but it seems like maybe we're crossing some sort of a Rubicon. So really curious to hear the conversation you're going to have with our experts today. And before we hit our trio of local news stories, it is another giveaway Wednesday. All summer, we're giving out tickets to great events in our region, but you got to stick around to the end of the show when we're going to reveal that event and give you the chance to win. All right, story number one is last night, fierce parent backlash at Cheltenham School District School Board meeting last night. It was the first public forum for the Cheltenham School District community to make their voices heard after the revelations came out detailing the abuse and harassment in the football program last summer. Let's hear some of that public testimony.
Clearly what happened at the high school is not a one-off incident. This is occurring across schools and across grade levels.
We are demanding a fundamental shift and how our school district operates.
The board and district leadership must move beyond accountability to present a comprehensive plan for supporting the amazing Cheltenham School District staff.
That's sound courtesy of our news partners at 6ABC. And last night, the school board pledged to review safety procedures, assess the culture in its sports programs, and rebuild trust. In the context here, of course, Avi, is this grand jury report recently came out and blamed the board and school leaders for mishandling assault allegations from a 15-year-old student that happened last summer. And last month, four Cheltenham High School football coaches and six players were charged on criminal counts by the Montgomery County District Attorney. Two of the students got adult assault charges. The coaches were pinned with endangering the welfare of a child and conspiracy to cover up a crime. Those coaches have been fired. Mm-hmm. The football season has been on hiatus. And then last week, the Cheltenham superintendent resigned. And this came right on the heels of an Inquirer article about how several families of the football program had basically been saying that they shouldn't hire this head coach, who ultimately was hired, Terrence Tolbert, based on what they saw as kind of a toxic environment when he was at Abington. School leaders ignored those warnings, hired him anyway, led to, you know, this culture that came at Cheltenham, which now has been uncovered, and Tolbert was one of the people who was criminally charged in this case. So that's where we are at the moment.
Yeah, and still so many unanswered questions. If you read that Inquirer report, there's a suggestion in there that perhaps this coach was hired because of a union rule about priority in hiring. And so I think there's some questions here about, did the school district feel that they were forced to hire this guy? They had to put him in line from other people. Did they really pick him? And despite the fact that there were all these warnings about his performance in his prior job in a school district, by the way, that's a neighboring school district. It's not like he was coming from across the country. So again, still some unanswered questions. And as you heard, a lot of parent anger and concern. Moving on to story number two now. So earlier this week, and I'm going to say the sentence, and it's not going to make any sense when I say it first, okay? Earlier this week, the Green Party of Pennsylvania filed paperwork to block a Green Party candidate from the ballot in a key congressional race. Let me explain. So Republican incumbent Ryan McKenzie is facing Democrat Bob Brooks in Pennsylvania's 7th District, Lehigh Valley. This is a big swing district race. There's a man named Andrew Tupone who collected signatures to run under the banner of the left-wing Green Party. But a spokesperson with the actual state party told the Pennsylvania Capital Star they've never heard of Tupone, and they don't endorse him. And they believe he misled voters when he collected those signatures to get onto the ballot. Tupone, by the way, was a registered Republican as recently as February of this year, which naturally raises the question, is he simply running as a spoiler to steal votes from the Democrat under the idea that someone who's to the left of center might choose a Green Party candidate over a Democratic candidate? Now, Tupone denies this. He says regardless of party affiliation, he's always had anti-establishment beliefs. And by the way, the Green Party is challenging this, but they might not have grounds for the challenge because of Pennsylvania's rules here. Third parties cannot hold primaries, so candidates have to collect signatures and run like Tupone did, even though the party had nothing to do with his effort.
Right. So he went out and he got the signatures. He got close to 10,000 signatures. Right. And so there's some challenge by both the Green Party and Democrats saying there's something up maybe with these signatures. And we'll see if those legal challenges go anywhere. It could just be a frivolous lawsuit. But so interesting, it kind of reveals, like you said, Avi, this quirk in, I guess, the state where if you're not you're not the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, there is no primary. It's all about who can get the signatures.
Right. And I didn't know that you could just do it as an independent agent. I didn't realize, I understood like the collecting signatures part of it. There wasn't a primary, but I didn't realize you didn't even have to contact, you didn't have to coordinate with the party at all. You just say, I'm running as a Green Party candidate. And you go out and you tell people that, you get the signatures, you're on the ballot.
Right. And we were reviewing, our colleague Lauren Maig from NBC 10 went up and talked to him and we were watching the interview and, he was convincedly saying, hey, I changed my views in 2023, 2024. I hadn't changed my party registration, but I started listening to more left-leaning media. It changed my mind. Yep. And here I am. Now, whether or not you believe him or you think this is some sort of covert Republican attempt.
And it matters because the margin in this race could be super thin. This was a district that was a democratically held seat, then flipped to Republican in the last election. And a lot of people believe could flip back, especially if Democrats are doing well overall this fall. We're talking about a few months away here. But in normal times, this is a district that can be decided by a few thousand votes.
And the gulf between Democrats and Republicans can easily sometimes, be overshadowed by whatever the Green Party candidate gets. So like Absolutely. You said, could really have an impact in that race. All right, Avi, story number three.
Ba-boom.
Picture this. You're 8 years old.
Oh, I like that.
You're out fishing.
Going back in time.
Fishing with your pop and Delco. You feel a little tug on that line. You're thinking, bass? Trout? No, Avi, piranha! That was the scene recently at Ridley Park Lake with father and son, Michael and Seamus Coffey.
I'm wearing it and I think there's a bass.
I was like, slow down, dude. You might lose it. This looks like something we haven't caught before.
And that was audio courtesy of our news partner, 6ABC. The Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission confirmed that idea of a piranha and says this incident speaks to a larger problem. And you know what? That 8-year-old, know how he knew it was a piranha?
How did he know it was a piranha?
He said, YouTube.
YouTube University told him?
Yep. So this larger problem is, they say, people getting exotic pets and then releasing them into the wild.
That's how they think the piranha got there, exactly. Into this Ridley Park Lake.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm sad it wasn't a barracuda, because then we could do a little heart here, boom bada 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 boom boom. But it's crazy. It's a little scary. It's a little freaky. I have no experience with exotic pets. I don't really understand the allure, but my understanding is that people sort of invest and buy, and then they don't realize what they've gotten themselves into, and then they say, "Let me get rid of this thing." My guess would be that what you're supposed to do, actually, the more humane thing to do, even, would be to kill the piranha as opposed to releasing it into local waterways.
Right, and it seems like that's what happened in this case. And this case actually kind of reveals a little hook on this new HBO documentary series by the makers of Tiger King, and that claims that our region here in Philly was a hotbed for this type of international reptile smuggling and collecting that can lead to this issue.
Really?
Back in the 70s, yeah.
Huh.
So there's this new series out called Monsters of God, and it centers on the rise and fall of this guy, Hank Molt, who became a big name in the exotic reptile trade in the 70s and was ultimately prosecuted for his role in an operation that buried a bunch of rare animals alive in the Pine Barrens. And his legacy, though, was a little complicated because it was his work bringing a lot of these exotic reptiles here that ultimately led to some of the creatures we still see in zoos today, because he sold them to the zoos and then the zoos bred them in captivity. But if it wasn't for him getting them to begin with, they might not be in the zoos.
Hank Molt. That has to be a pseudonym, right? That cannot be the man's real name. And then he got into reptile smuggling. Maybe they answered that in the documentary.
Maybe.
Hank Molt.
Yeah.
Like, it's calling yourself, like, Bob Scales. You know? Right? I mean, that can't be his real name. I don't know. Whatever. That is a fascinating subplot. Kevin, thank you for bringing that to our attention. I do want to tell you about the main plot today, which is our show. We're going to talk all about this recent wave of cyber attacks on water systems all across the country, including a couple in South Jersey. Want to hear your thoughts on this. 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant Cherry Gregg is off today. You've likely seen headlines about a wave of cyber attacks on water treatment facilities all across the country. Hackers linked to Iran targeted a couple dozen plants, including some in New Jersey. While the attackers were not able to compromise the water itself, these breaches have raised the alarm for municipal governments and cybersecurity experts, highlighting just how vulnerable these systems are. And it's not just water infrastructure that has been targeted in recent years. Our electric grid, oil and gas pipelines, and transportation systems have also been hit. So today, we're going to talk about the threats to our critical infrastructure, how to secure them, and how we can prepare if the power or water goes offline. As always, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think America should be doing to prevent hacks on utility systems? Do you have questions? Just general questions about all of this. And do you do anything to prepare in your personal life? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Hop on the line. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can comment in the live chat. And we've got two cybersecurity experts who will join us shortly, but we want to lead off with a firsthand account from one of the New Jersey towns hit by this cyber attack wave. And joining us on the line right now is Cape May Mayor Zachary Mullock. Zach, thanks for being with us on Studio 2.
Avi, thanks so much for having me.
So first, take me back to when you heard there was a problem. Who told you what, and when did that happen?
Yeah, so we got an email in the morning that we had been hacked, which obviously was very surprising to myself and the rest of City Council. Apparently, just at the end of July, or at 2:30 in the morning, there was an alert given to our water department staff that our water tank was low, and they couldn't figure that out because it seemed like the pumps were on. So they came in and recognized that the pumps weren't on and very quickly realized that we had been hacked.
So whatever digital interface they were using was telling them the pumps were on, but the pumps themselves were indeed off.
That's correct. Mm. And I do give a little credit to the state. The NJCCIC came right down by 7 o'clock in the morning and very quickly figured out the issue.
Yeah.
But obviously very scary.
Yeah. And so is there a sense that that's all the hackers did, just sort of flipped those pumps off? Is there a sense from forensics that they actually did more? What do you know at this stage? And is there an ongoing investigation?
There is an ongoing investigation. And, you know, we immediately, and to the credit of our staff, they figured this out quickly, contacted the FBI, the DEP, New Jersey CCIC. And, you know, one of the advantages that we had is the fact that a lot of our systems are not online. If more of the systems were available online, we could have had a major issue. And just to tell you, Avi, too, we are one of the only desalinization plants in the East Coast. And we also service many other municipalities, including the U.S. Coast Guard Training Center here in Cape May.
Yeah.
So it could have been pretty bad, frankly.
So this is critical infrastructure. You said most of what you have is offline, or I guess in a closed loop system. But there was some part of the system that was networked, that was connected to the broader World Wide Web. What was connected and why was it connected?
Those pumps, they could control the pumps to make sure that they were filling the tank at night and things like that. So that's what the weakness was. Mm. And, you know, I think the thing that I've learned along the way here is that this isn't just one person, you know, hacking. They can use AI. They're looking at multiple systems at once. It's, you know, I think everybody feels like geography has separated us for a long time. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
How were you guys able to assure the public and assure yourselves that the water was indeed safe? Because you knew someone had messed with the pumps. That doesn't mean they hadn't messed with any other part of the system. What did you do to make sure you knew for sure that the water hadn't been compromised, the quality of the water?
Well, that was the first thing that they looked into, and both the DEP and the NJCCIC looked at that immediately. And once they recognized that it was only the pumps that were affected, they realized that there was nothing else that they could have done. But again, I have to tell you a couple things with this is one of the issues that I see is we've cut back funding for cybersecurity. And I find that to be insane considering where we're going and where we're at war right now. I just feel like we have to make sure that these agencies are funded to be able to protect small municipalities like Cape May. You know, we're 3,000 people, we could be up to 100,000 in the summertime on a beautiful day like today, but we don't have the capability to fight modern warfare. We need to rely on the feds and state government agencies, and they have to be funded.
In the meantime, is there an argument that you should sort of deconnect, de-technologize the things that are connected to the internet in your system?
Yes. And I would state that to anybody listening, especially in regards to some of the bigger water plants, you know, have more connected to chemical mixes and things like that. And obviously that could be a major issue. Luckily in Cape May, that's not the case. And we believe that we've fixed any security flaws. But the fact is, and in speaking to many people in cybersecurity at this point, the unfortunate thing is if people want to really get in and hack your systems at a certain point, it becomes very difficult in stopping them from doing that, which, frankly, to your point, is a lot of these systems seem to be need to not be connected to the internet.
Yeah. Before I let you go, you guys decided to be public with this, to say that this has happened. Not every municipality has followed suit. And there's a lot of mystery out there, I think, among the public about just how widespread these attacks are. I am curious what went into your decision to say, look, we've detected the threat and this is what happened, instead of perhaps shielding that information.
I mean, when it comes to water, to me, transparency is paramount. I mean, I have three kids that live here in Cape May. My family drinks this water. I consider my community my family, frankly. And we wanted to let people know as soon as possible. But, of course, we don't want to give up any national security issues. So we worked with the FBI and the NJCCIC to make sure that, that we gave the public information as soon as possible. Yeah. And when they said that, yes, it makes sense to do that now, that's when we did it.
Well, that is Cape May Mayor Zachary Mallock. Thank you, Mayor Mallock, for your time today on Studio 2.
Avi, thank you so much.
And now let me introduce our two cybersecurity experts who are going to be with us the rest of the hour answering your questions. And by the way, get those in 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Just to my right here in studio is Dr. Anshul Rege, a criminology professor at Temple University, who directs the Cybersecurity and Application Research and Education Lab, or the CARE Lab. Dr. Rege, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And let me also welcome Joshua Corman, cyber safety and security strategist and executive in residence at the Institute for Security and Technology. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I want to start with you, Joshua Corman, talking about what we know and don't know about this wave of attacks. I've seen reports that there were water systems in 12 states impacted, perhaps 100 municipalities or more. Do you think the scale is greater than that? Do you think this attack is ongoing? Give me your assessment of scope.
Sure. You can double click all you want as well. The devices compromised are basically this one. It's a programmable logic controller, a very common device where, you know, where IT moves packets and cat pictures and data. OT, your operational technology, moves physics and heavy machinery. So this is one of the most pervasive and common devices across the country. So the initial reporting was Minnesota had 30 plus, then it was 3 states, then 12. Our informal information groups are tracking more than 20 states. And one should assume that since this is this particular device type is around 80% market share in North America, and it's going to bring in all 50 states. We have the same internet, same equipment, same adversary with the same objective. So
so you think these attacks are ongoing, or there's just more that have happened that have just not been revealed to us yet?
Well, CIS has been alerting of a campaign from Iranian hackers since April. They updated their alert in July, shortly after that July 22nd update of stealthy maneuvers to shut off alarms and silence and bypass alarms. You saw a dramatic uptick, almost like they were motivated to hurry up and compromise more. In fact, many called this an attack. I don't think this was an attack. I think this was a mistake. The payload, the level of access they enjoy could do significantly more harm to physical property, to loss of life, to no water, no hospitals, no kidding, within 2 hours, maybe less in the summer. But for the choice to lock out the owner by changing the password, they may not have been noticed for quite some time. Many of these failures seem minor and passive from a loss of control of your equipment, as opposed to the kind of payloads at the national security level that we've been tracking and concerned with for a different nation state adversary of Volt Typhoon from China.
Let me just understand. You said there's a difference between an attack and a mistake. Just explain to me in layman's term what you see as the difference.
Well, there is a distinct possibility this could have been signaling from what's most likely Iranian-affiliated hackers during our ongoing hot and cold hostilities and negotiations. But it would work cross-purpose to their goals. They seem to be ramping up the number of systems they wanted access to. And when you enjoy that unfettered access, you can trigger a payload or an attack at a time and place of your choosing. If we get into Volt Typhoon and the People's Liberation Army, we can talk about what they've been doing for even longer. So if your goal was to hurt Americans or to scare Americans, this was more of the reconnaissance stage than the actual harm.
Interesting. Yeah, and I want to bring you in now, Dr. Anshul Rege, to talk about just how unusual this is, because what Joshua Corman was saying suggests that maybe it's not as unusual as we think, that perhaps these threats have been lurking and working their way through various infrastructure systems for a while now. What we've experienced or what we've learned about over the last few weeks or months, is that just sort of pulling the cover off of something that's already existed for a long, long time? Or is this truly, in terms of scale and scope, an unusual wave of attacks?
I think what was different about this one is probably the scale, their repeatability of it, and the impact. And what do I mean by that, right? You see a lot more coordination here, which you haven't seen before. So the fact that, you know, multiple utilities across multiple states in a short period of time, that's something that was, you know, a little bit different this time. Is this something that's new in general? If I were to take away the scale or the coordination aspect of it, no, this has been happened before. And you can look at it from multiple different, you know, who's behind the attack, right? Is it state sponsored? Is it ransomware? Is it a disgruntled insider? This has happened before. You know, the Queensland sewage hack from probably now almost 2 decades ago.
Australia.
Yeah, right. Where disgruntled insider actually, who had helped design the system, once he was done with it, still had access to it and broke in and released 1 million liters of raw sewage into public waters, right? So is this new?
The possibility has existed for a long time.
The proof of concept has been done, as far as I'm concerned, right? When we're looking at water, wastewater. So again, to me, it's not new. What was new is the coordination and the scale of it. And just getting across multiple states, multiple sites,
And they seemed to identify a common weakness. We heard Joshua Corman mentioned earlier this device. Do we know why that was a weak point? And was it a known weak point before all of this started? Your thoughts first.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad Joshua brought up the PLCs, right? Or the programmable logic controllers, excuse me. These, in this instance anyways, a lot of these systems were using the same types.
Right.
And so... and
sounds like basically they had a monopoly over this.
Pretty much, right?
There's a near monopoly over this type of thing.
That is correct.
In the American market.
Right. And, you know, you have to remember, going back to what the mayor said, most of their systems are offline, but some of them are. And these systems were able to be accessed through the internet. Yeah. So part of the reason...
Can I stop you actually on that? Because we have a comment from Deborah who says, the issue's not new. Yeah. It's existed ever since systems began using the internet. Yep. Utilities need to resist the temptation to monitor their systems remotely, i.e. through the internet, but rather need to use closed-loop systems. This mm-hmm. opens them up to vulnerabilities, and what is remotely monitored should have several firewalls that are constantly upgraded. These things are expensive and difficult for utilities to fund and maintain, particularly small ones. So a lot in Deborah's comment.
Yes.
But one of the points that she made there very strongly is that there's no reason for any of this to be connected to the internet. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like from what she was saying, it's really for convenience's sake, not for the sake of the safety of the waters. Is that true?
I would have to say yes. Okay. Right. So a lot of times site operators cannot go to all sites in a limited amount of time. Remember, these facilities have small budgets, limited staff, and it's impossible to be in different sites at the same time. And that's why having these types of systems connected does bring that convenience.
From one screen, I can monitor several sites.
Right. And it just helps, right? Yep. So I think, you know, there is the automation piece of it, the remote control piece of it, which is absolutely important, right, to just the maintenance and operations of the facility. Having said that, the comment is fantastic because there's certain things that we can do, that we should do to still keep these systems safe.
I want to get to that later, but Joshua Corman, I want you to weigh in on this. Why are there elements of water systems, electrical grids, oil and gas pipelines, for instance, that are connected to the World Wide Web? They're networked out into the world. Why does that exist, and should it exist?
So many things can be true at the same time. I want to show some compassion for these small, medium, and rural water facilities who are increasingly having their budgets cut or their staff cut. No one wants to raise the price of delivering water. But in fact, in many cases, it was the pandemic and our suppliers that kind of pushed us to connect these devices to the internet. So two things can be true. When you add things to the internet, you expose us to accidents and adversaries. Most of them wanted information or money, but now we have some that want to disrupt and destroy, at least two. So we were always prone, we were always prey, but we had an air gap and no predators. We now have predators. So, you know, to channel my inner Stan Lee, with great connectivity comes great responsibility. So we adopted this on purpose to save money and be more convenient, but there's a cost we clearly did not calculate correctly, and that reckoning has to happen now. Unfortunately, the pandemic kind of accelerated this. People were having sickness and death and reduced workforce, so they started adding more remote connectivity to not drive across town. But number two, this is the big suppliers of tech. They're increasingly requiring a persistent internet connection for like licensing or predictive
maintenance. They're requiring it. They're requiring it. Why would they require it?
They're pushing us into this for business value, for market share, for differentiation. Systems integrators that install and service these want access. So even if the municipality doesn't want to be hyperconnected, if they want to stay safer offline, we used to call this an air gap.
Yep.
That air gap, you know, these were never designed to be connected, but now they are almost increasingly permanently connected. In fact, CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, just launched a program called CI Fortify, where they're encouraging people to do a day without internet or a day without SCADA controls to make sure that if you were to lose the systems you depend upon, you can still manually operate. And the pushback we got from most of the country is, we don't believe we can manually operate anymore. So we're in a period where we're maybe over-dependent on unimpeachable technology.
We can't do it anymore because the technology companies won't allow us. They've trapped us into this, or we just don't have the skill level anymore. We don't have the sort of institutional knowledge to do it. Why can't they do it? Why can't they revert to the way it used to be done?
Well, the benefits of automation allowed us to replace aging workforce that was leaving with their local wisdom and knowledge. We couldn't afford to cross train double duty. And it's the systems integrators as well that are increasingly picking up the load. They're often the lowest bidder. So it's quite possible many of these devices that were compromised were because they were configured insecurely by the same integrators and then would copy and paste across the states that they served. So we are where we are. It's a very dangerous place. We can try to fall back or rationalize, make sure the highest consequence equipment and failures aren't on the internet. There are really low hanging things you can do for this particular one, but it may not be sufficient. This wasn't even hacked per se. There were no passwords on these. They were directly on the internet. So there's
I have
some
to stop you for a second. I'm sorry. You said no passwords.
Correct.
On these. So Anshul Rege, you wanted to chime in on that. For the layperson, that sounds crazy. Okay. That there's no passwords. What does that mean in this context? Is that industry practice? Is that just because they don't have the capability? I'll let you both chime in on this.
And Joshua, feel free to go first.
Go ahead, Joshua. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one important thing here, and it's because of the competing truths that there's no money in water and we don't want to overburden them, but you have more cybersecurity regulations for your credit card and your wallet than you do for the water systems that support our country. There is no national regulation. The state of New York is the only one to start leaning in here, and they're adding some minimum cyber hygiene. So we haven't really pushed, quote, best practices. We know some of the things one could do, but if it's an unfunded mandate, or rather even states might control the pricing increases, we are very far away from right-sizing the cost benefit of connectivity.
But I'm still hung up on the no password because, I mean, I need a password to log into this computer I'm looking at right now in front of me, and it has almost no valuable information on it. Trust me. Dr. Rege, why wouldn't there be...
If there's no passwords, it might actually be default passwords that were never changed, right? Yeah. So that's, you know, something else as well. And that's what happened, right? Passwords got changed and folks lost access.
Were locked out.
Yeah, locked out, couldn't see, couldn't control, couldn't monitor the equipment. So
I want to get to one bigger question here. We're coming up on a break, but this is related to a question from one of our, or comment from one of our listeners. And by the way, if you have comments and questions on this topic, give us a call right now, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Chris, calling in from the New Jersey Turnpike, says, this is just starting. I fear with AI, these kinds of attacks will be happening all the time. I asked earlier, should these systems have any connectivity to the internet? Because the question embedded in that, Anshul Rege, is whether or not, even with best practices, we could protect them from the most serious threats and the most sophisticated attackers. And with AI and other emerging technologies, is it even possible with best practices to protect any infrastructure system that is connected to the internet at all?
So I'm going to say that technology will fail. Humans will make errors. And, you know, adversaries will sometimes get in, right? That's just a given. Anytime you connect something online, that's it. You've increased the attack surface. What I will say, though, is, you know, should we absolutely, you know, can we absolutely get rid of it? I don't know, right? I mean, we just heard Joshua said that if this is being pushed on, you know, these types of sites and you may not have an option to opt out, that might be difficult to do. So, you know, I think the important part is learning to build in resiliency and redundancy, right? So in this case, when you just heard the mayor, they detected it, something was off, then they came on site and they did it. So to me, I think you need to have a fully built out sort of system, right? Yes, we have automation. Yes, we have these safety systems installed. Yes, we have trained staff, human operators that realize that something's wrong.
And know what to do.
Know how to intervene, know how to like take things offline, so on and so forth.
Well, we'll have a lot more coming on the other side of this break. I also want to talk, you know, frankly, about what the worst case scenarios look like here. So we're going to get to that on the other side of this break. More of your comments as well. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. Before we get back to our conversation about how we can keep our municipal utility systems safe from hackers, it's time to reveal this week's Giveaway Wednesday event. I know you've been eagerly awaiting this one. Charlie, hit it.
Follow my love, love,
And that is the sound of Los Lobos, the iconic LA band known for their unique blend of Mexican folk and American rock music. On September 3rd, they'll be in KOP as part of the Concerts Under the Stars series. Two tickets to the show would run you $110, but if you're the fifth person who emails us right now at studio2@whyy.org, you'll get a pair on us. Now back to our big question of the day. What do you think the U.S. should do to prevent hacks on utility systems? Have you done anything to prepare? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Leave a comment in the live chat. And let me reintroduce our guests. Dr. Anshul Rege is a criminology professor at Temple and directs the Cybersecurity and Application Research and Education Lab, the CARE Lab. And Joshua Corman is a cyber safety and security strategist and executive in residence at the Institute for Security and Technology. I teased this before the break, Joshua, but what we've just experienced is clearly not the worst case scenario because it seems like no one was harmed. What does a worst case scenario look like in terms of, let's just start with water systems, leaving aside other infrastructure?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because this device is pervasive in other sectors besides water. It's just we tended to see some of them pop up recently in water. I'll give you a few, but I'll reserve a few to myself. It's important to understand that one of the Iranian objectives here is to scare and panic Americans. So I don't necessarily want to carry their water for them.
Yep.
But if we want to have a sober conversation with the asset owners and operators here or leadership like the mayor who kicked this off, this can be pretty serious property damage. These devices do exactly what the plant operators could do. So you should ask yourself, what could you do if you went evil? And that's pretty much a lot. So you could do property damage. I'll give you three examples. They're tiny. One is the chief concern we have for the Volt Typhoon concerns from China are what's called a water hammer. It's a naturally occurring event in a water facility where it's force equals mass times acceleration, but turning on or off a valve too quickly can create enough pressure to burst a water main, like you might see gushing water on Main Street or an open field. And everyone downstream of that is without water. And my chief concern is not the 151,000 water plants across the country, but the 6,000 that support one of the hospitals in the country, because no water is no hospital quickly. The second one could be if you turn on and off these pumps really quickly without proper safeguards, you could burn out the motors. And this is $250,000 pump times three, might take 18 to 24 months to replace. So that property damage could be affected as well. And these controls significant and serious chemicals. So there is the potential for adulteration, accidental or otherwise. There was a town in Massachusetts near me that had chemical burns. If you saw the movie Fight Club with the chemical burn on his hand, that caustic soda accidentally escaped and burned 100 citizens or so in Spencer, Massachusetts. So these are pretty important industrial equipment that we have these devices to set safety thresholds and to monitor safety thresholds. And even when they're simply disabled, we could see property damage, harm to citizens, or even loss of life, especially for a dependency like a hospital.
And what we know of the hacks that occurred or the attacks that occurred, could the people who perpetrated this have done the things that you said and chose not to, or did they not have the level of access to manipulate the sensors and the systems in such a way to cause that level of damage?
Yeah, the reason this scurried all of our national security relationships is that this device is all you need. People often like to say, oh, they got in this way and they did privilege escalation and lateral movement to get to the actual juicy center. This is the juicy center. These devices are the things that sense the levels that you set for safety and actuate an outcome. So there's enough here.
And they control chemicals as well, chemicals that we would use to treat water?
They can, which is has to be scrutinized by local leadership as to if that's sound and prudent to be connected. I would argue no, at least for the time being, especially if you're using one of the known implicated devices. However, we're not going to panic everyone. Thus far, the payloads have not been bad. There are one of the things I like to do is empower people, not just scare people. So at least for our project, we talked about resilience right before the break. We're not going to cyber up in time, certainly not to fight off Iranian hackers or the Chinese military. So while the threats come from cyber, the solutions often come from engineering. We just testified to Congress recently that if you were to think about what's the highest consequence failure, like a loss of water pressure event, there are often known familiar, effective, and affordable engineering solutions that plant operators could do. And what we've been demonstrating is for under $10,000 in a town, we can engineer down the consequences. So you assume you're hacked, you assume they'll fail, but you're managing the highest consequence impact to the town.
You mentioned a couple times this the threat of Chinese affiliated hackers. I want you to explain a little about what you mean there and what we know about what hackers affiliated with the Chinese government have done in this space.
So there's plenty of information at u27.org. We even have some nice explainer videos. That's part of our mission here. But this is an unclassified, you know, publicly known campaign called Volt Typhoon, like Volt is in electricity. The Chinese military has compromised water, power, communications, and transportation. But what's the mission? Why would they do this? Well, Xi Jinping has told his military he'd like to take Taiwan as early as 2027, hence the name. No one thinks it'll be 27 anymore. I'll tell you when if you ask me. However, they want the U.S. to stay out of this fight. And as part of their unrestricted warfare doctrine, Volt Typhoon is to do just that.
It's leverage,
but also delay and degrade. So its two objectives stated are we want to delay and degrade the movement of troops and equipment from the U.S. mainland to the theater even a day or two. Would advantage them. That sounds like a military thing. Maybe you wouldn't care as a listener, but here's where you should. This is the part that upset and motivated me. They've also targeted non-combatant civilian infrastructure to disrupt and destroy, to sow chaos on civilians, to undermine our will and support to intervene. So they're using us as leverage, my family as leverage, in little towns like Littleton, Massachusetts, 10,000 people, no military strategic input, no manufacturing relevance. It's the whole point is it's everyday Americans.
You mentioned a little town there in Ancho Reggae. I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of our, like the big picture vulnerability and perhaps resilience of the American system. It seems like our it almost seems like they're the same thing. Our vulnerability is that we have split our infrastructure into a million different pieces. Every little town's got their own water system. That's a problem because little towns maybe can't afford really sophisticated cybersecurity. But it seems like also an advantage in the sense that there's not one thing you can necessarily strike, not one domino that tips all the other dominoes over. Is that unique to the water system? Does it apply to electrical grid? Like when you look at sort of our big picture vulnerability on this front, what does it look like?
I'm going to say it's fragmented.
Fragmented.
Definitely fragmented, but the fragmented systems might be using similar types of devices.
And that's
the problem.
That's the weakness.
That's the problem. And that's how I understand this, right? So again, in this case, systems may be fragmented, but if they're using just a handful, right, there's not a lot of companies that are providing these PLCs. There's just a handful of them. So it's not difficult to figure out, okay, well, if this system here in this part of the country uses, you know, this product, it's very likely going to be used in a couple of different places. So if you figured out how to get at that one, you know, you can get at other ones too.
When it comes to cybersecurity, do we have our priorities mixed up? Because one thing Joshua mentioned earlier is that we often think about this problem in terms of money, in terms of our personal data, you know, the type of sort of identity theft fraud. We don't often think about this. And I think the obvious answer is you want to do both. You want to protect on both fronts.
Right.
But do we focus too much on the personal liability and the money side and not enough on the hard infrastructure side when we talk about cybersecurity?
I'm going to have to say yes to that. Right. Okay. And going also back to what the mayor said is a lot of, you know, and what Joshua said also, especially with the smaller, you know, municipality systems, they don't have, it's limited budgets, it's limited staff, it's limited resources. So you can't, you know, say, oh, they should have done better or they should have had better systems in place when you don't give them the ability to do so. And I think this is a shared responsibility. Like you need utilities, you know, to just build systems with or try systems with better cybersecurity. You need manufacturers to build equipment with cybersecurity in mind. You need vendors to configure it, right? And then, of course, you need the government to have the standard. So it really is a shared sort of responsibility and a large ecosystem that really needs to play together.
David on YouTube says the U.S. should adopt enforceable minimum cybersecurity standards for critical infrastructure operators covering multi-factor authentication, network segmentation, and secure by design practices. Joshua Corman, we haven't talked about other infrastructure all that much yet. Are grids, do grids present, like electrical grids, do they present different types of challenges? Are they better secured, worse secured? What can you tell us about that? Oil and gas pipelines? I know we can't do it all, but give us a sense of where these other infrastructure systems sit in terms of cybersecurity.
Absolutely. The Presidential Policy Directive 21 during the Obama admin designated 16 sectors, and they are not evenly prepared. To give us a little bit of kindness, you know, that William Sutton line, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. we responded early and often to the most attacked sectors, like financial services is probably the strongest of the cybersecurity regulations and preparedness as a public-private partnership with the government. Water is probably the weakest. Second strongest is Department of Energy. To someone's point earlier, it is incredibly resilient. It turns out it shouldn't be, but it is pretty resilient. And we often have a generator to fill the gap. If you do lose power for, you know, I live in New England, we have to use a generator occasionally in the winter for a couple of days. There's really no equivalent of a generator for drinkable, potable water for the hospital. So when you look across the 16, some of the weakest are water, healthcare, food supply, because we haven't historically had adversaries preying upon them. And that's what's changed. I think we've been shocked here to assume the good faith of every stranger. And now we have a couple that deliberately do want to disrupt and destroy. And at the moment, our only mitigation is the appetite of those predators. And I don't want to depend on flawless execution of their restraint. So even the attempt to just maybe scare or warn us could have had physical impact. So to me, I don't look at them as all 16 are equal. What I say is, what are the lifeline sectors that if you shut them off for 24 to 48 hours could lead to loss of life or hurt social cohesion? And water is right at the bottom on its own, but it's also no water, no fire hydrants, no water, no food supply, no cold chain, no HVAC for data centers. So this really seems to be the most foundational of the neglected lifeline critical functions. And this hopefully is a reckoning that it's not about the money that Wall Street makes. It's about basic human needs and basic safety and protection for citizens, much like we have a common defense.
You mentioned Willie Sutton there, and I'll add Willie Sutton once held at and escaped from Eastern State Penitentiary right here in Philadelphia. So we'll get that Philly connection in there. Margaret asks, can your guest tell us whether we can rely on our current administration to give us accurate, expert, truthful information about these threats? Have too many departmental experts been fired to keep us safe? Anshul Rege, do you want to take a crack at that? What do we know about our federal government's preparedness and forthrightness here?
Yeah, I can probably answer more about the preparedness than I can about the forthrightness. So I this is not just the current administration. I think infrastructure security, going back to also what, you know, Joshua said, it depends on which, you know, not all sectors being evenly prepared. And this this doesn't just date to the current administration. It goes, you know, as far back as our systems have been connected to the internet. So are we prepared? Some sectors more than others. Can the current administration do more? Of course. I think we have still got a long ways to go. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Luann also asks, do we need to start scrutinizing the companies that provide the equipment? Could they be infiltrated? Joshua Corman, you mentioned, right, that there's some of these companies have incentivized systems to be more connected. You mentioned that some have very large market shares, which creates unique vulnerabilities. Do we need to do more in terms of oversight of the companies that provide the equipment and the connectivity?
Yeah, someone mentioned in a previous comment, Secure by Design, which is a CISA program to amplify the need for us to have trustworthy, transparent digital infrastructure, especially in areas like this.
Yeah.
And some of them are trying. Like one of the bigger players is Schneider Electric. And what they'll tell you is our newer devices, our newer models are more secure by design. They do support multi-factor authentication, et cetera. But they also know that most of their customers are using a 15, 20-year-old unsupported end-of-life one because they have no money. So this is a shared responsibility where we need more trustworthy, transparent equipment from the manufacturers. They need to be purchased and deployed when they're high consequence, and we need to create budgets for those. And the systems integrators in the middle need to make sure we're turning on these security capabilities, not leaving them by default passwords or naked on the internet. So unfortunately, everyone's made a bunch of errors to get us here. And it's going to take some actions from many players to get us out of this. But it really starts with what are the highest consequence failures? How do we ensure they don't happen? And the economics and incentives currently are not there, but there was a bill introduced by Adam Schiff and Amy Klobuchar this past week to possibly reignite conversations about empowering the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to finally have regulatory minimums and some stimulus to help these smaller target-rich cyber poor. It's not got a bipartisan support yet. It doesn't have the support of industry yet, but the Overton's window is changing where we're starting to realize that we are much more exposed than we previously thought.
Well, I'm not sure I'll sleep great tonight, but I do appreciate the information from both of you. Joshua Corman, founder of I Am the Cavalry, a grassroots cybersecurity organization and former chief strategist of the CISA COVID Task Force. Thank you so much for your time today on the program.
Thank you.
And Dr. Anshul Rege, criminology professor at Temple, directs the CARE Lab there. Really appreciate your time on Studio 2. You guys were both wonderful.
Thank you.
And I'll also thank our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Charlie Kyer and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.